Far above his head, the remains of an enormous crystal chandelier, filthy and askew, dangled from the groined ceiling. Bits of material that looked like seaweed hung from its still graceful curves. The ceiling was a great dome, tiled in mirrors that were now shattered and webbed, hovering above him like a ruined, glittering sky. Although he could not make out the center of the large space, Pendergast saw a series of stone steps placed at irregular intervals leading ahead into the darkness. The muddy footprints followed these steps. In the center was some kind of structure, an information kiosk, perhaps, or ancient refreshment area. The walls of the room curved away from him into the distance, pillared in Doric columns of crumbling plaster. Between the nearest columns was an enormous tiled mural, trees, a quiet lake with a beaver dam and beaver, mountains, and an approaching thunderstorm were all depicted in ruined complexity. The decayed condition of the mural and its shattered tiles would have reminded Pendergast of Pompeii, were it not for the furious sea of dried mud and filth that had swept up along its lower edges. Broad streaks of ordure, like a giant's finger painting, ran crazily up the walls. Along the crown of the mural, Pendergast could make out the name Astor in complex tile work. He smiled. Astor had originally made his fortune in beaver pelts. This had indeed been a private sanctuary for a few very rich families. The next bay contained another great mural, this one depicting a steam locomotive crossing a river gorge, pulling a line of hopper and tank cars and framed by snow-capped peaks. The name Vanderbilt was tiled above it, a man who had made his fortune in railroads. In front of the mural lay an ancient ottoman, its arms askew and its back broken, mildewed stuffing pouring from the rent pillows. Farther along, a niche marked Rockefeller depicted an oil refinery in a bucolic setting, surrounded by farms, the distillation columns tinged by the sunset. Pendergast took a step into the large space. He watched the rows of columns recede into darkness, the grand names of the Gilded Age glowing red in his goggles, Vanderbilt, Morgan, Jessup, others too faint to make out. Pendergast moved slowly along the wall, watching for any movement. At the far side of the room, a corridor marked Two Hotel led to two ornate elevators, their brass doors wide open and stained with verdigris, the cars inside in complete devastation, cables draped along the floor like iron snakes. Inset into a nearby wall between two shattered mirrors was a mahogany schedule board, warped and rotten with wormholes. Though the bottom of the board had fallen away, he could make out the lettering across the top. 1014A. Dest. Pocantico Hills. Cold Spring. Hyde Park. Time. 1014A. 1042. 11:03. Beside the timetable was a small waiting area of disintegrating chairs and sofas. Amidst them, Pendergast saw what had once been a Bösendorfer concert grand. The floods had rotted and then stripped most of the wood away, leaving a massive metal frame, keyboard, and wild nest of broken strings, a musical skeleton, now silent. Pendergast turned toward the center of the room and listened. The silence was broken only by the distant sound of dripping water. He glanced around and saw a stream of shivering drops falling from the ceiling. He began moving forward, scanning in the direction of the archway and platform for a flash of white in the goggles that would indicate something warmer than the surrounding environment. Nothing. The goatish smell became stronger. As the shape in the center began resolving itself in the red and green haze of his goggles, Pendergast realized it was too low and squat to be a kiosk. Now he could see that it was a crudely made structure, a hut of smooth white stones with only a partial roof, apparently unfinished, surrounded by low platforms and pedestals. Moving still closer, he could see that what he had thought were stones were actually skulls. Pendergast stopped and took several breaths of the cleansing oxygen. The entire hut had been constructed of human skulls, anterior sides facing outward. Ragged holes yawned through their backs, glowing eerily green in his goggles. He counted the skulls from floor to roof, then did a rough estimation of the diameter. A quick calculation told him that the circular wall of the hut was formed of roughly 450 skulls. Hair and scalp fragments showed that most, if not all, of the skulls were fresh. Pendergast circled to the front of the hut, then waited outside the entrance for several minutes, motionless. The tracks ended here, thousands of them, in a mad jumble of prints around the opening. Above it, he could see three oriental ideographs painted in some dark liquid. There was no sound, no movement. Taking a deep breath, he crouched, then spun toward the inside. The hut was deserted. Ceremonial clay goblets, at least 100 or more, had been placed on the floor along the inside wall. Outside the entrance stood a simple stone offering table, perhaps 4 feet high and 2 in diameter. It was surrounded with a fence made out of what appeared to be human long bones, lashed with rawhide. Some odd-looking metal parts had been arranged on the table and covered with rotting flowers, as if part of a shrine. Pendergast picked up one of the parts and examined it in surprise. It was a flat piece of metal with a worn rubber handle. The other, equally mundane items provided no further clues. He slipped a few of the smallest into his pocket. Suddenly, a flash of white registered in his goggles. Quickly, he dropped to a kneeling position behind the table. All seemed quiet, and he wondered if he had been mistaken. Occasionally, the goggles could be fooled by thermal layers in the air. But there it was again, a shape, human, or nearly, loping through the archway from the platform beyond, a white blob leaving an infrared track on his field of view. It appeared to be clutching something to its chest as it ran toward him with terrifying speed. In the thick dark, Pendergast silently raised his gun in one hand, his flash apparatus in the other, and waited. 40. Margot sat back in the flimsy institutional chair, massaging her temples lightly with her fingertips. After Frock's departure, the meeting had quickly degenerated into disagreement. Horlocker left the room for several minutes to speak privately with the mayor. He returned with a city engineer named Hausman. Now Jack Masters, head of NYPD's Tactical Response Unit, was also on the phone. But so far they had made little progress toward any course of action.
"Look,"
came the voice of Masters, tinny and distorted through the speakerphone.
"It's taken my people almost half an hour just to verify the existence of these Aster tunnels. How can we insert a team?"
"Send several teams, then," Horlocker snapped. "Try different entrance points. Use a wave approach so we know at least one team will make penetration."
"Sir, you can't even tell me number or condition of the, well, whatever you call them, and the terrain is unfamiliar. The tunnel system beneath Manhattan is so complex my men would be compromised. There are too many unknowns. Too many ambush points."
"There's always the bottleneck," said Hausman, the city engineer, chewing fretfully on the end of his pen. "The what?" Horlocker replied. "The bottleneck," said the engineer. "All the piping in that quadrant has to go through a single large blast hole, maybe 300 feet down. The Aster tunnels are below that somewhere." "There you go," Horlocker said into the speakerphone. "We could seal it off and proceed from there, right?"
There was a pause.
"I suppose so, sir."
"So we could trap them?"
"Maybe."
Masters sounded dubious even through the speakerphone.
"But what then? We couldn't lay siege, and we couldn't very well go in and root them out. It would be a stalemate. We need more time to grid the route."
Margot glanced at Dagosta, looking on disgustedly. It was what he'd been recommending from the beginning. Horlocker pounded on the table.
"God damn it, we don't have time! I've got the governor and the mayor breathing down my neck. They've authorized me to take any action necessary to stop these killings, and I plan to do just that."
Now that Horlocker had made up his mind, his determination, his impatience, was remarkable. Margot wondered just what it was the mayor had said in their telephone conversation that had so put the fear of God into the police chief. Hausman, the engineer, removed his pen from his mouth long enough to speak. "How can we be sure these creatures live in the Aster tunnels anyway? I mean, underground Manhattan's a large place." Horlocker turned toward Margot. She cleared her throat, aware of being put on the spot.
"From what I understand," she said, "there are a lot of underground homeless throughout the tunnels. If there were a concentration of these creatures elsewhere, the homeless would know about it. Like we said earlier, there's no reason to doubt the word of this Mephisto. Besides, if the creatures have any of the characteristics of the Umbuan beast, they'll shun light. The deeper their nest, the better. Of course," she added quickly, "Pendergast's report will..."
"Thank you," Horlocker said, stepping hard on her final words. "Okay, Masters, you've got the brief."
The door swung open suddenly, the squeaking of rubber wheels announcing Frock's return. Margot looked up slowly, almost afraid to see the expression on the old scientist's face.
"I think I owe everyone here an apology," he said simply, wheeling up to the table. "As I went through the museum's halls just now, I did my best to look at things objectively. And on reflection, I'm afraid I may well have been wrong. It's difficult to admit it, even to myself, but I suppose the theory advanced by Margot best fits the facts."
He turned toward Margot. "Please forgive me, my dear. I'm a tiresome old man, overly fond of his pet theories, especially when it comes to evolution."
He smiled wanly. How noble, Horlocker said, but leave the soul-searching for later.
We need better maps,
the voice of Masters continued,
and more information about the hostiles' habits.
Damn it, Horlocker cried. Aren't you hearing me? We don't have time for a geological survey here. Waxy, what's your take on this?
There was a silence. Frock eyed Waxy, who was staring out the window as if hoping to see the much-needed answers spray-painted across Central Park's great lawn. The captain frowned, but no words came.
The first two victims, Frock said, still eyeing Waxy, appear to have been washed out in a storm.
So they were nice and clean when we found them, Horlocker growled.
Good, so what?
The gnaw marks on these victims don't show signs of hurried work, Frock continued. It would appear the creatures had plenty of time to do their work unmolested. That would imply the bodies were near, or perhaps in, their lair at the time the marks were made. There are numerous analogues in nature.
Yeah?
If a few victims can be flooded out by a storm, what would it take to flood the lair itself?
That's it! Waxy cried, turning from the window in triumph. We'll drown the bastards!
That's crazy, said the Ghosta.
No, it isn't,
Waxy said, pointing excitedly out the window.
The reservoir's got to drain out through the storm system, right? And when the storm drains get overloaded, doesn't the overflow go into the Astor tunnels? Wasn't that why you said they were abandoned?
There was a short silence. Horlocker turned toward the engineer with a quizzical look, who nodded.
It's true. The reservoir can be dumped directly into the storm drain and sewage system.
Is it feasible? Horlocker asked.
Houseman thought a minute.
I'll have to check with Duffy to be sure. But there are upwards of 2,000 acre-feet of water in the reservoir, at least. That's 90 million cubic feet. If even a fraction of that water, say 30%, were suddenly released into the sewer system, it would completely overwhelm it. And as I understand it, the overflow would go into the Astor tunnels, then on into the Hudson.
Waxy nodded triumphantly.
Exactly.
Seems like a pretty drastic step to me, the Ghosta said.
Drastic? Horlocker repeated. Excuse me, Lieutenant, but we just had the better part of a subway train massacred last night. These things are out for blood, and it's getting worse fast. Maybe you'd prefer to walk up and give them a summons or something, but that just won't do the trick. I've got most of Albany on my back demanding action. This way,
he waved his hand in the direction of the window and the reservoir beyond,
we can get them where they live.
But how do we know exactly where all this water's going to go?
DeGosta asked. Houseman turned to DeGosta.
We have a pretty good idea. The way the bottleneck works, the flow will be confined to the very lowest level of the Central Park quadrant. The overflow shunts will direct the water straight down through the bottleneck into the deepest storm drains and the Astor tunnels, which in turn drain into the west side laterals and finally into the Hudson.
Pendergast did say that the tunnels south and north of the park had been sealed off years before,
DeGosta said, almost as if to himself.
Horlocker looked around, a smile creasing his features. To Margot, it looked awkward, as if Horlocker didn't use those particular muscles very often.
They'll be trapped beneath this bottleneck, swept away and drowned. Objections? Anybody?
You'd have to make sure all the creatures were down there when you let the reservoir go, said Margot.
Horlocker's smile faded.
Shit. And how the hell can we do that?
The Ghosta shrugged.
One of the patterns we found was that no killings occurred during a full moon.
That makes sense, Margot replied. If these creatures are like Mbun, they hate light. They probably remain below during the full moon.
What about all the homeless living down there under the park? The Ghosta asked.
Horlocker snorted.
Didn't you hear, Houseman? The water will go straight to the lowest levels beneath the city. We've heard the homeless shun that area. Besides, the wrinklers would have killed any that wandered too deep.
Houseman nodded.
We'll plan a limited operation that wouldn't flood anything but the Astor tunnels.
And any moles that might be camping out in the path of the descending water?
The Ghosta persisted.
Horlocker sighed. Ah, shit. To be on the safe side, I guess we'd better roust them out of the Central Park quadrant and put them in shelters.
He straightened.
In fact, we could kill two birds with one stone, and maybe even get that Wisher woman off of our backs to boot.
He turned to Waxy.
Now this is what I call a plan, he said. Nicely done.
Waxy blushed and nodded.
It's a hell of a big place down there, the Ghosta said, and those homeless people aren't going to go willingly.
The Ghosta? Horlocker snapped. I don't want to hear you whining any more about why it can't be done. For Christ's sakes, how many homeless are we talking about below Central Park?
100? It's a lot more than...
If you got a better idea, Horlock interrupted, let's hear it. Otherwise, stow it.
He turned to Waxy.
Tonight's the full moon. We can't afford to wait another month. We'll have to do it now.
He leaned toward the speakerphone.
Masters, I want all underground spaces in the vicinity of Central Park cleared of homeless before midnight. Every damn tunnel from 59th Street to 110th and from Central Park West to 5th Avenue. A night in the shelters will do the moles good. Get the Port Authority, the MTA, anyone you need. And get me the mayor. I'll need to brief him on our plan of action. Get the rubber stamp.
You'll need some XTA cops down there, DeGosta said. They've done rousting details. They'll know what to expect.
I disagree, Waxy said immediately. Those moles are dangerous. A group of them almost killed us just a couple of days ago. We want real cops.
Real cops, DeGosta repeated. In a louder tone, he added, then at least take Sergeant Hayward.
Forget it, Waxy said. She'll just be in the way.
Just shows how much you know, DeGosta snapped.
The most valuable resource you had, Waxy, and you never bothered to tap her potential. She knows more than anyone about the underground homeless. You hear me? More than anyone. Believe me, you'll need her expertise on a roster this size.
Horlocker sighed. Masters, make sure to include the Sergeant Hayward on the field trip.
Waxy, contact what's-his-name, Duffy, at the Water Authority. I want those valves opened at midnight.
He looked around.
We better move this down to Police Plaza. Professor Frock, we could use your assistance.
Margot watched as Frock, despite himself, beamed with pleasure at feeling useful.
Thank you for that, but I think I'll go home and rest first, if I may. This business has quite exhausted me.
He smiled at Horlocker, winked at Margot, and rolled out the door. Margot watched him go.
Nobody else will ever have any idea how much effort it cost him to admit he was wrong, she thought.
DeGosta began following Horlocker and Waxy into the corridor, then he stopped and turned back to Margot.
Thoughts?
He asked. Margot shook her head, bringing herself back.
I don't know. I understand there's no time to waste, but I can't help remembering what happened when...
She hesitated.
I just wish Pendergast was here, she said at last.
The phone rang, and she moved to answer it.
Margot Green here.
She listened for a long moment, then hung up.
You'd better go on ahead, she said to DeGosta. That was my lab assistant. She wants me downstairs right away.
41. Smithback pushed aside one man in a seersucker suit and dug his elbow into another, trying to force his way through the thickening mob. He'd badly underestimated just how long it would take him to get here. The crowd was jammed solidly for almost 3 blocks worth of Fifth Avenue real estate, and more were arriving every minute. Already, he'd missed Wisher's opening speech in front of the cathedral. Now he wanted to reach the first candlelight vigil before the crowd began moving again.
Watch it, asshole!
A young man brayed loudly, removing a silver hip flask from his lips just long enough to speak.
Go suck on a long bond, Smithback retorted over his shoulder as he struggled forward.
He could hear policemen now beginning to work the edges of the crowd, trying ineffectually to clear the avenue. Several news crews had arrived, and Smithback could see cameramen climbing onto the roofs of their vans, craning for a good shot. It seemed that the wealth and power concentrated in the first rally had now been joined by a much larger, much younger crew, and they all had taken the city by surprise.
Hey, Smithback!
Turning, the journalist made out Clarence Kaczynski, a Post reporter on the Wall Street beat.
Can you believe this? Word spread like lightning.
Guess my article did the trick, Smithback said proudly.
Kaczynski shook his head.
Hate to disappoint you, pal, but your article only hit the streets half an hour ago. They didn't want to take the chance of alerting the cops too early. Word got passed in late afternoon over the services. You know, broker's wires, the NYSE network, Quotron, Lexus, all the rest. Seems the boys downtown have really taken to this whole Wisher thing. They think she's the answer to all their white bread problems, he snickered. It's not just about crime anymore. Don't ask me how it happened, but the talk in all the bars is that she's got twice the balls the mayor has. They think she's going to cut welfare, clean up the homeless, put a Republican back in the White House, bring the Dodgers back to Brooklyn all at once.
Smithback looked around.
I didn't know there were so many financial types in the whole world, let alone Manhattan.
Kaczynski snickered again.
Everybody assumes that Wall Street types are all retro yuppie drones in boring suits with 2.5 children, a house in the Jersey suburbs, and treadmill cookie-cutter existences. Nobody remembers the place has a whole sleazy underbelly, too. You got your Merck Exchange floor runners, bond strippers, interest rate swappers, pork belly traders, boiler room operators, money launderers, you name it. And we're not exactly talking upper crust here. We're talking some real Archie Bunker types. Besides, it isn't just Wall Street anymore. Word's going out by pager, network, and broadcast fax now. The back offices of banks and insurance companies everywhere are coming to join the party.
Ahead,
Between the rows of heads, Smithback made out Mrs. Wisher. Saying a hasty goodbye to Kaczynski, he pushed his way forward. Mrs. Wisher was standing in the stately shadow of Bergdorf Goodman, flanked by a Catholic priest, an Episcopalian minister, and a rabbi, in front of a 3-foot pile of fresh flowers and cards. An effete-looking, long-haired young man wearing a pinstripe suit and thick violet socks stood mournfully to one side. Smithback recognized the hangdog face as that of the Viscount Adair, Pamela Wisher's boyfriend. Mrs. Wisher looked spare and dignified, her light hair pulled severely back and her face without makeup. As he switched on his tape recorder and thrust it forward, Smithback couldn't help thinking that she was a born leader. Mrs. Wisher stood silently, head bowed for a long moment. Then she turned toward the assembled crowd, adjusting a wireless microphone. She cleared her throat dramatically.
"Citizens of New York!"
she cried. As a hush fell over the crowd, Smithback looked around, startled by the clarity and volume of her voice. He made out several people scattered strategically through the crowd, holding portable speakers on metal poles. Despite the spontaneous look of the march, Mrs. Wisher and her people had clearly thought things out in great detail. When the silence was complete, she resumed in a quieter voice.
"We are here to remember Mary Ann Cappelletti, who was mugged and shot to death at this spot on March 14th. Let us pray."
Between her sentences, Smithback could hear the police bullhorns more clearly now, ordering the crowd to disperse. Mounted police had arrived only to find the crowd too heavy for them to move in safely, and their horses pranced at the fringes in frustration. Smithback knew that Mrs. Wisher had deliberately not sought a parade permit this time in order to cause maximum surprise and consternation at City Hall. Like Kaczynski had said, announcing the march over the private services made for an efficient system of communication. It also had the advantage of bypassing law enforcement, the general media, and municipal government, who only got wind of the event when it was too late to stop it.
"It's been a long time," Mrs. Wisher was saying, "a very long time since a child could walk in New York City without fear. But now even adults are afraid. We're afraid to walk the streets, to stroll through the park, to ride the subway."
An angry murmur rose at this reference to the recent massacre. Smithback added his own voice to the crowds, knowing that Mrs. Wisher had probably never hung from a strap in her life.
"Tonight,"
she cried suddenly, eyes glittering as she surveyed the crowd,
"tonight we will change all that, and we will start by taking back Central Park. At midnight we will stand, unafraid, on the great lawn."
A roar rose from the crowd, growing in intensity until the pressure of it seemed almost to constrict Smithback's chest. He turned off his cassette recorder and stuffed it into his pocket. It couldn't handle the noise, and besides, he wouldn't need any help remembering this event. He knew that, by now, other journalists would have arrived in force, national as well as local. But he, Smithback, was the only journalist with exclusive access to Annette Wisher, the only reporter provided with details of the march. Not long before, a special afternoon edition of the Post had begun appearing on newsstands. It included an insert that displayed maps of the march and listed all the stopping points at which the murder victims would be memorialized. Smithback felt a flush of pride. He could see that many people in the crowd had a copy of the insert in their hands. Kaczynski didn't know everything. He, Smithback, had helped spread the word far and wide. Newsstand sales would no doubt go through the roof, and it was the best kind of circulation. Not just working-class types, but a good smattering of affluent, influential people who normally read the Times. Let that dweeb Harriman explain this particular phenomenon to his fossilized, dung-encrusted editor. The sun had fallen behind the towers and minarets of Central Park West, and a warm summer evening was gathering in the air. Mrs. Wisher lit a small candle, then nodded to the clergyman to do the same.
"Friends," she said, holding the candle above her head, "let our small lights and our small voices unite into one raging bonfire and one unmistakable roar. We have but one goal, a goal that cannot be ignored or resisted, to take back our city!"
As the crowd took up the chant, Mrs. Wisher moved forward into Grand Army Plaza. With a final shove,
Smithback forced himself past the front row and into the small entourage. It was like being inside the eye of a hurricane. Mrs. Wisher turned toward him.
"I'm delighted you could make it, Bill," she said, as calmly as if Smithback were attending a tea party.
"Delighted to be here," Smithback replied, grinning widely in return.
As they moved slowly past the Plaza Hotel and onto Central Park South, Smithback turned back to watch the great mass of people swinging in behind them like some vast serpent sliding its bulk along the boundaries of the park. Now he could see more people ahead of them as well, flowing out from 6th and 7th Avenues, coming down to join them from the west. There was a healthy scattering of old-moneyed blue bloods in the crowd, sedate and gray, but Smithback could see growing masses of the young men Kaczynski had been talking about, bond salesmen, bank AVPs, brawny-looking commodity traders, drinking, whistling, cheering, and looking as if they were spoiling for action. He remembered how little it had taken to rouse them into throwing bottles at the mayor, and he wondered just how much control Wisher could exert on the crowd if things got ugly. The drivers of the vehicles along Central Park South had given up honking and had left their vehicles to watch or join the throng, but a vast caterwauling of horns was still rising from the direction of Columbus Circle. Smithback breathed deeply, drinking in the chaos like fine wine.
"There's something unbelievably bracing about mob action," he thought.
A young man hustled up to Mrs. Wisher.
"It's the mayor," he panted,
holding out a cellular phone. Tucking the microphone into her purse, Mrs. Wisher took the phone.
"Yes,"
she said coolly, without breaking stride. There was a long silence.
"I'm sorry you feel that way, but the time for permits is long past. You don't seem to realize this city is in an emergency, and we're putting you on notice. This is your final chance to bring peace to our streets."
There was a pause while she listened, placing a hand over her free ear to shut out the noise of the crowd.
"I'm grieved to hear that the march is hindering your policemen, and I'm pleased to know that the chief of police is mounting some operation of his own. But let me ask you a question. Where were your policemen when my Pamela was murdered? Where were your..."
She listened impatiently.
"No, absolutely not. The city is drowning in crime, and you are threatening me with a citation. If you have nothing else to say, I'll hang up. We're rather busy here."
She handed the phone back to her assistant.
"If he calls again, tell him I'm engaged."
She turned to Smithback, slipping one hand into his arm.
"This next stop is the site where my daughter was killed. I need to be strong for this, Bill. You'll help me, won't you?"
Smithback licked his lips.
"Yes, ma'am," he replied.
42. The Gosta followed Margot down a dusty, poorly lit hall on the first floor of the museum. Once part of an ancient exhibit, the hall had been sealed from public view for years and was now used primarily as overflow storage space for the mammalian collection. Various stuffed beasts, in postures of attack or defense, lined both sides of the narrow corridor. DaGosta nearly snagged his jacket on the claw of a rearing grizzly. He found himself keeping his arms close to his sides to avoid brushing against the rest of the moldering specimens. As they rounded a corner into a cul-de-sac, DaGosta saw a huge, stuffed elephant dead ahead, its much-repaired gray skin tattering and flaking. Beneath its massive belly, hidden in shadow, was the two-story metal door of a freight elevator.
"We gotta make this quick," he said as Margot pressed the elevator button. "One police plaza has been mobilizing all afternoon. Looks like they're getting ready to storm the Normandy beaches. Besides that, there's some kind of surprise rally by Take Back Our City forming along Fifth Avenue."
There was a smell in the air that reminded him of certain summer crime scenes he'd visited.
"The preparation lab is just down the hall," Margot said, watching as DaGosta's nose wrinkled. "They must be macerating a specimen."
"Right," said DaGosta. He glanced up at the huge elephant overhead. "Where are the tusks?"
"That's Jumbo, P.T. Barnum's old showpiece. He was hit by a freight train in Ontario, and his tusks were shattered. Barnum ground them up, made jello out of them, and served it at Jumbo's memorial dinner."
"Resourceful?"
DaGosta slid a cigar into his mouth. Nobody could complain about a little smoke with a reek like this.
"Sorry," said Margot, grinning sheepishly. "No smoking. Possibility of methane in the air."
DaGosta put the cigar back in his pocket as the elevator door slid open.
"Methane. Now there was something to think about. They stepped out into a sweltering basement corridor lined with steam pipes and enormous packing crates. One of the crates was open, exposing the knobby end of a black bone big as a tree limb.
Must be a dinosaur, the Ghosta thought.
He struggled to control a feeling of apprehension as he remembered the last time he'd been in the museum's basement. We tested the drug on several organisms, Margot said, walking into a room whose bright neon lights stood in sharp contrast to the dingy corridor outside. In one corner, a lab worker was bending over an oscilloscope.
Lab mice, E. coli bacteria, blue-green algae, and several single-celled animals. The mice are in here.
The ghost appeared into the small holding area and stepped back quickly.
Jesus!
The white walls of the stacked cages were flecked with blood. Torn bodies of dead mice littered the floors of the cages, shrouded in their own entrails. Margot peered into the cages.
You can see that of the four mice originally placed in each cage, only one remains alive.
Why didn't you put them all in separate cages? The ghost asked.
Margot glanced up at him.
Leaving them together was the whole point. I wanted to examine behavioral as well as physical changes.
Looks like things get a little out of hand.
Margot nodded.
All of these mice were fed the Umbuan lily, and all became massively infected by the real virus. It's highly unusual for a virus that affects humans also to affect mice. Normally, they're very host-specific. Now, watch this.
As Margot approached the topmost cage, the surviving mouse leapt at her, hissing, clinging to the wire, its long yellow incisors nibbing the air. Margot stepped back.
Charming, said the ghosta. They fought to the death, didn't they?
Margot nodded.
The most surprising thing is that this mouse was badly wounded in the fight. But look at how thoroughly its cuts have healed. And if you check the other cages, you'll see the same phenomenon. The drug must have some powerful rejuvenative or healing properties. The light probably makes them irritable, but we already know that the drug makes one sensitive to light. In fact, Jen left one of the lights on, and by morning the colony directly beneath it had died.
She stared at the cages for a moment.
There's something else I'd like to show you, she said at last. Jen, can you give me a hand here?
With the lab assistant's help, Margot slid a divider across the topmost cage, trapping the live mouse on one side. Then she deftly removed the remains of the dead mice with a long pair of forceps and dropped them into a Pyrex basin.
Let's take a quick look,
she said, carrying the pieces into the main lab and placing them on the stage of a wide-angle stereo zoom. She peered through the eyepieces, probing the remains with a scapula. As the ghosta looked on, she sliced open the back of a head, peeled the skin and fur away from the skull, and examined it carefully. Next, she cut open a section of spinal cord and peered closely at the vertebrae.
As you can see, it looks normal, she said, straightening up. Except for the rejuvenative qualities, it seems the primary changes are behavioral, not morphological. At least, that's the case in this species. It's too early to be sure, but perhaps Kawakita did succeed in taming the drug in the end.
Yeah, the ghosta nodded. After it was too late.
That's what's been puzzling me. Kawakita must have taken the drug before it reached this stage of development. Why would he take such a risk, trying the drug on himself? Even after testing it on other people, he couldn't have been sure. It wasn't like him to act so rashly.
Arrogance, said the ghosta.
Arrogance doesn't explain turning yourself into a guinea pig. Kawakita was a careful scientist, almost to a fault. It just doesn't seem in character.
Some of the most unlikely people become addicts, the ghosta said. I see it all the time. Doctors, nurses, even police officers.
Maybe.
Margot sounded unconvinced.
Anyway, over here are the bacteria and the protozoans we inoculated with the real virus. Strangely enough, they all tested negative. The amoebas, paramecia, rotifers, everything. Except for this one.
She slid open an incubator, exposing rows of petri dishes covered with purple agar. Glossy, dime-sized welts in each dish of agar indicated growing colonies of protozoans. She removed a dish.
This is B. meristerii, a single-celled animal that lives in the ocean, growing in shallow water on the surface of kelp and seaweed. It usually feeds on plankton. I like to use them because they're relatively docile and they're exceptionally sensitive to chemicals.
She carefully dragged a wire loop through the colony of single-celled animals. Smearing the loop on a glass slide, she seated the slide on the microscope tray, adjusted the focus, then stepped away so DaGosta could take a look. Peering into the eyepiece, DaGosta couldn't see anything at first. Then he made out a number of round, clear blobs, waving their cilia frantically against the gridded background.
"I thought you said they were docile," he said, still staring.
"They usually are."
Suddenly, DaGosta realized that the frenzied maneuvering was not random at all. The creatures were attacking each other, ripping at each other's external membranes and thrusting themselves into the breaches they created.
"And I thought you said they ate plankton."
"Again, they normally do," Margot replied. She looked at him. "Creepy, isn't it?"
"You got that right."
DaGosta backed away, inwardly surprised at how the ferocity of these tiny creatures somehow made him feel squeamish.
"I thought you'd want to see this."
Margot stepped up to the microscope and took another look herself.
"Because if they plan on—"
She paused, stiffening, as if glued to the eyepiece.
"What is it?"
DaGosta asked. For a long minute, Margot didn't respond.
"That's odd,"
she murmured at last. She turned to her lab assistant.
"Jen, will you stain some of these with eosinophil? And I want a radioactive tracer done to find out which are the original members of the colony."
Motioning DaGosta to wait, Margot helped the lab assistant prepare the tracer, finally placing the entire treated colony under the stereozoom. She peered into the microscope for what seemed to DaGosta like an eternity. At last she straightened up, scratched some equations into her notebook, then peered into the stereozoom once again. DaGosta could hear her counting something to herself.
"These protozoa," she said at last, "have a normal lifespan of about 16 hours. They've been in here 36. B. maris gerii, when incubated at 37 degrees Celsius, divides once every 8 hours. So,"
she pointed to a differential equation in her notebook,
"after 36 hours you should see a ratio of about 7 to 9 dead to live protozoa."
"And?"
DaGosta asked.
"I just did a rough count and found the ratio was only half that."
"Which means?"
"Which means the B. maris gerii are either dividing at a lower rate or—"
She put her eye back to the microscope, and DaGosta could hear the whispered counting again. She straightened up again, this time more slowly.
"The dividing rate is normal," she said in a low voice.
DaGosta fingered the cigar in his breast pocket.
"Which means—"
"They're living 50% longer," she said flatly.
DaGosta looked at her a moment.
"There's Kawakita's motive," he said quietly.
There was a soft knock at the door. Before Margot could answer, Pendergast glided in, nodding to them both. He was once again attired in a crisp black suit, and his face, though a little drawn and tired, betrayed no sign of his recent journeys beyond a small scrape above the left eyebrow.
"Pendergast," DaGosta said. "About time."
"Indeed," said the FBI agent. "I had a feeling you'd be here too, Vincent. Sorry to have been out of touch so long. It was a somewhat more arduous journey than I had imagined. I would have been here to report my encounter half an hour earlier, but I felt a shower and change of clothes to be rather essential."
"Encounter?" Margot asked incredulously. "You saw them?" Pendergast nodded.
"I did, and much else besides. But first, please bring me up to date on events above ground. I heard about the subway tragedy, of course, and I saw the troops in blue massing as if for Runnymede, but there's obviously much that I've missed."
He listened intently as Margot and DaGosta explained about the true nature of Glaze, about Whittlesea and Kawakita, and about the plan to flush out the Astor tunnels. He did not interrupt except to ask a few questions while Margot was sketching out the results of her experiments.
"This is fascinating," he said at last. "Fascinating. And extremely unsettling."
He took a seat at a nearby lab table, crossing one thin leg over the other.
"There are disturbing parallels here to my own investigations. You see, there is a gathering point deep in the Astor tunnels. It's located in the remains of what was once the Crystal Pavilion, the private train station beneath the defunct Knickerbocker Hotel. In the center of the pavilion, I found a curious hut built entirely of human skulls. Countless footprints converged on this hut.
Nearby was what appeared to be an offering table, along with a variety of artifacts. While I was examining it, one of the creatures approached out of the darkness.
"What did it look like?"
Margot asked, almost reluctantly. Pendergast frowned.
"Difficult to tell. I never came that close, and the NVD I was wearing does not resolve well at distance. It looked human, or close to it, but its gait was, well, it was off, somehow."
The FBI agent seemed uncharacteristically at a loss for words. "It squatted forward in an unnatural way as it ran, cradling something that I believe was meant as another addition to the hut. I blinded it with a flash and fired, but the sudden brilliance overloaded the goggles, and by the time I could see again, the thing was gone."
"Was it hit?" the ghost asked.
"I believe so. Some blood spoor was evident, but by that point I was somewhat anxious to return to the surface." He looked at Margot, one eyebrow raised. "I would imagine that some of the creatures are more deformed than others. In any case, there are three things we can be sure of. They are fast, they can see in the dark, and they are completely malevolent."
"And they live in the Aster tunnels," Margot shivered, "all under the influence of Glaze. With Kawakita dead and the plants gone, they're probably mad with need."
"It would seem so," Pendergast said.
"And this hut you describe was probably the site where Kawakita dispensed the drug," Margot continued. "At least toward the end, when things were getting out of hand. But it all sounds almost ceremonial."
Pendergast nodded.
"Precisely. Over the entrance to the hut, I noticed Japanese ideographs translating roughly to Abode of the Unsymmetrical. That is one of the names used to describe a Japanese tea room."
The ghost frowned.
"Tea room? I don't understand."
"Neither did I, at first. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized what Kawakita must have done. The roji, or series of steps placed at irregular intervals in front of the hut, the lack of ornamentation, the simple, unfinished sanctuary, these are all elements of the tea ceremony."
"He must have distributed the plant by steeping it in water, like tea," Margot said. "But why go to all that trouble, unless..."
She paused.
"Unless the ritual itself..."
"My own thought, exactly," Pendergast said. "As time went on, Kawakita must have had increasing difficulty controlling the creatures. At some point, he abandoned selling the drug and realized he simply had to provide it. Kawakita was also trained as an anthropologist, correct? He must have understood the settling, the taming influence of ritual and ceremony."
"So he created a distribution ritual,"
Margot said.
"Shamans in primitive cultures often use such ceremonies to institute order, preserve their power."
"And he chose the tea ceremony as the basis," Pendergast said. "Whether reverently or irreverently, we'll never know. Though I would guess it was a cynical addition on his part, considering his other borrowings. Remember the burned notes you found in Kawakita's lab?"
"I have them right here,"
the ghost said, pulling out his notebook, flipping pages, then handing it to Pendergast.
"Ah, yes. Green cloud, gunpowder, lotus heart. These are green teas of varying rarity."
Pendergast pointed to DeGosta's notebook.
"And this, dung-loving Bluefoot. Strike a chord, Dr. Green?" "It should, but it doesn't."
Pendergast's lips twitched in a slight smile.
"It is not one substance, but two. What members of the Route 666 community would no doubt label shrooms."
"Of course,"
Margot snapped her fingers.
"Carulipes and coprophylla."
"You lost me," the ghost said.
"The Bluefoot psilocybe and the dung-loving psilocybe," Margot said, turning to the lieutenant. "Two of the most potent hallucinogenic mushrooms there are."
"And this other item, whistlecan," Pendergast murmured. "If memory serves, that was a ritual drink used by the Algonquin Indians during coming-of-age ceremonies. It contained significant amounts of scopolamine, jimson weed, a very nasty hallucinogen causing deep narcosis."
"So you think this is a laundry list?" the ghost asked.
"Perhaps. Perhaps Kawakita wanted to modify his brew in some way, making the drug users more docile. If you're right, and Kawakita wanted to keep the glaze users under control, then why this hut of skulls? Margo asked. It seems to me building something like that would have the opposite, inciting effect.
True enough, Pendergast said. There is still a large piece missing from this puzzle.
A hut built entirely of human skulls, Margo mused. You know, I've heard of that before. I think there was a mention of something like that in Whittlesey's journal.
Pendergast looked at her speculatively.
Really? Interesting. Let's check the archive. We can use the terminal in my office.
The rays of the late afternoon sun shone through the lone window of Margot's cramped office, cloaking papers and books in a mantle of gold. As Pendergast and DaGosta looked on, Margot sat down at her desk, pulled the keyboard toward her, and began to type.
The museum got a grant last year to scan all its field notebooks and similar documents into a database, she said. With any luck, we'll find the journal here.
She initiated a search on three words, Whittlesey, Hut, and Skulls. The name of a single document appeared on the screen. Margot quickly called it up, then scrolled ahead to the penultimate entry. As she read the words, coldly impersonal on the computer screen, she was irresistibly reminded of the events of 18 months before, sitting in a darkened museum office with Bill Smithback, looking over the journalist's shoulder as he paged eagerly through the moldy notebook.
Crocker, Carlos, and I press on. Almost immediately stopped to repack crate. Specimen jar had broken inside. While I repacked, Crocker wandered off trail, came upon ruined hut in the center of a small clearing. It appeared to be made entirely from human skulls, pegged with human long bones set hakal fashion into the ground. Ragged holes cut through back of each skull, small offering table in the center of the hut made from long bones lashed with sinew. We found the figurine, along with some oddly carved pieces of wood, on table. But I get ahead of myself. We brought gear down to investigate, reopened crate, retrieved tool bag. Before we could investigate hut, old native woman wandered out from brush, staggering, sick or drunk, impossible to tell, pointed to crate, wailing loudly.
That's enough, Margot said more abruptly than she meant to, clearing the screen. The last thing she needed now was another reminder of the contents of that nightmare crate.
Very curious, Pendergast said. Perhaps we need to sum up what we know so far.
He paused a moment, poised to tick off the items on his slender fingers.
Kawakita refined the drug known as glaze, tested it on others, then used an improved version on himself. The unfortunate users, deformed by the drug and increasingly shy of light, went underground. Growing feral, they began preying on the subterranean homeless. Now, in the wake of Kawakita's death and loss of the glaze supply, their predations have become bolder.
And we know Kawakita's own motive for taking the drug, Margot said. The drug seems to have a rejuvenating ability, even the ability to extend one's lifespan. The underground creatures were given an earlier version of the drug he gave himself, and it seems he continued to perfect the drug even after he began taking it. The creatures in my lab show no physical abnormalities at all, but even his most refined drug has negative effects. Look how aggressive and homicidal it made the mice, and even the protozoa.
But that still leaves three questions, DaGosta said suddenly.
They turned to look at him.
First, why did these things kill him? Because it sure seems obvious to me that's what happened.
Perhaps they were growing ungovernable, Pendergast said.
Or they became hostile to him, seeing him as the cause of their troubles, Margot added.
Or perhaps there was a power play between him and one of the creatures. Remember what he wrote in his notebook? The other one grows more eager by the day?
Second, what about that other mention in his notebook? The herbicide, thioxin? That doesn't seem to fit anywhere. Or the vitamin D you said he was synthesizing?
And don't forget Kawakita also wrote the word irreversible in his notebook, Pendergast said. Perhaps he ultimately realized that he could not undo what he had done.
And that might account for the remorse he seemed to show in his notebook, Margot said. Apparently he concentrated on ridding the drug of its physical changes, but in the process he ignored what his new strain might do to the mind.
Third and last, DaGosta continued.
What the hell was the point of rebuilding this hut of skulls mentioned in Whittlesey's journal? At this, everyone was silent. At last, Pendergast sighed.
You're right, Vincent. I find the purpose of that hut incomprehensible. As incomprehensible as the odd pieces of metal I found on its offering table.
Pendergast removed the small items from his jacket pocket and spread them on Margot's work table. DeGosta picked them up immediately, examining them closely.
Could they just be pieces of garbage?
He asked. Pendergast shook his head.
They were carefully, even lovingly arranged, he said, like relics in a reliquary.
A what?
A reliquary. Something used to hold or display revered objects.
Well, they don't look reverential to me. They look like the pieces to a dashboard, or some appliance, maybe.
DeGosta turned to Margot.
Any ideas?
Margot stood up from the computer terminal and walked over to the work table. She picked up a piece, studied it a moment, then put it down.
This could be anything,
she said, picking up another, a tube of metal with one end encased in gray rubber.
Anything, Pendergast agreed.
But I sense, Dr. Green, that when we know what they are, and why they were lying enshrined on a stone platform 30 stories below New York City, we'll have the key to this puzzle.
43. Hayward shouldered the riot gear, adjusted the lantern visor strapped around her head, and glanced across the mass of blue milling around the lower concourse of the 59th Street station. She was supposed to find Squad 5, led by a Lieutenant Miller, but the vast space was in chaos, everyone trying to find everyone else and consequently finding nobody. She saw Chief Horlocker arrive, fresh from mustering the squads that were assembling at the 81st Street station under the museum. Horlocker took up a position on the far side of the concourse next to Tactical Head Jack Masters, a thin, sour-looking man. Masters' long arms, which usually hung down by his side like an ape's, were now gyrating as he talked to a group of lieutenants, slapping a series of maps, tracing out imaginary lines. Horlocker stood by, nodding, holding a pointing device like a swagger stick, occasionally tapping it on the map to emphasize a particularly salient point. As Hayward watched, Horlocker dismissed the lieutenants, and Masters picked up a bullhorn.
Attention!
He barked in a rasping voice.
Are the squads assembled?
It reminded Hayward of Girl Scout camp. A rumbling murmur that might have been no arose.
Squad 1, here then,
Masters said, pointing toward the front.
Squad 2, assemble at the downtown level.
He continued through the squads, assigning them various sections of the concourse. Hayward headed for the Squad 5 assembly point. As she arrived, Lieutenant Miller was spreading out a large diagram of his own squad's area of responsibility, shaded in blue. Miller was wearing a light gray assault uniform whose loose folds could not conceal a generous load of adipose tissue.
I don't want no heroics, no confrontations, Miller was saying. Okay, it's basically a traffic cop assignment, nothing fancy. If there's any resistance, you got your mask and your tear gas. Don't fart around, show them you mean business. But I don't expect any trouble. Do your job right, and we'll be out of here in an hour.
Hayward opened her mouth, then restrained herself. It seemed to her that using tear gas in underground tunnels might be a little tricky. Once, years before the transit police merged with the regular force, someone at headquarters had suggested using gas to quell a disturbance. The rank and file almost revolted. Tear gas was bad enough on the surface, but it was murderous below ground. And she could see that their detail covered the deeper subway and maintenance tunnels beneath Columbus Circle Station. Miller looked around again, the dark glasses around his neck swinging on day-glow crokies.
Remember, most of these moles are wigged out on some shit or other, maybe weakened by too much juice, he barked. Show them some authority and they'll fall in line. Just move them up and out like cattle, if you know what I mean. Once you get them started, they'll keep going. Head them toward this central point here, beneath the number 2 turnaround. That's the staging point for groups 4 through 6. Once the groups have reassembled, we'll move the moles up to the Parkside subway exit here.
Lieutenant Miller,
Hayward said, unable to keep silent any longer. The lieutenant looked at her.
I used to roust some of those tunnels, and I know these guys. They're not going to move along as easily as you think they are.
Miller's eyes widened as if seeing her for the first time.
"You?"
he asked in disbelief.
"A rouster?"
"Yes, sir," Hayward said, thinking she'd give the next guy who asked her that a swift kick in the balls.
"Jesus,"
said Miller, shaking his head. There was a silence as the other cops looked at Hayward.
"Any other XTAs here?"
Miller asked, looking around. Another officer raised his hand. Hayward quickly took in the obvious features. Tall, black, built like a tank.
"Name?"
"Carlin,"
the heavyset man drawled.
"Any others?"
Miller asked. There was a silence.
"Good. Us, ex-transit police, we know these tunnels," Carlin said in a mild voice. "Too bad they didn't think to enlist more of us for this picnic, sir."
"Carlin," Miller said, "you got your gas, you got your stick, you got your piece, so don't wet your pants. And when I want your opinion again, I ask for it."
Miller looked around.
"There are too many goddamn bodies in here. This action calls for a small elite group, but what the chief wants, the chief gets."
Hayward glanced around herself, estimating there were perhaps 100 officers in the room. "There's at least 300 homeless beneath Columbus Circle alone," she said evenly.
"Oh? And when did you last count them?" Miller asked.
Hayward said nothing.
"There's one in every group," Miller muttered to no one in particular.
"Now listen up. This is a tactical operation, and we've got to be tight and obey orders. Is that understood?"
There were a few nods. Carlin caught Hayward's eye and rolled his own briefly toward the ceiling, indicating his opinion of Miller.
"All right, partner up,"
Miller snapped, rolling up the chart. Hayward turned toward Carlin, and he nodded in return.
"How you doing?"
he asked. Hayward noticed her first impression of the officer as overweight was wrong. He was strongly built, cut like a weightlifter, not an ounce of fat anywhere.
"What was your beat before the merge?"
"I had the tour under Penn Station. The name's Hayward."
Out of the corner of her eye, she could see a derisive look cross Miller's face. Carlin and the broad.
"This is really a man's job," Miller said, still looking at Hayward. "There's always the chance things could turn a little ugly. We won't hold it against you if..."
"With Sergeant Carlin here," Hayward interrupted, "there's enough man for the both of us."
She swept her eyes appraisingly over Carlin's massive frame, then looked pointedly at Miller's stomach. Several cops erupted into laughter, and Miller frowned.
"I'll find something in the rear for you two."
"Officers of the law!"
Horlocker's voice suddenly barked through the bullhorn.
"We have less than 4 hours to clear the homeless from the areas beneath and surrounding Central Park. Keep in mind that precisely at midnight, millions of gallons of water will be released from the reservoir into the storm drain system. We'll be channeling the flow precisely, but there's no guarantee that a couple of wandering homeless won't get caught in the downward rush of water. So it's imperative that your work be done and everyone within the clear zone evacuated well before the deadline. Everyone. This is not a temporary evacuation. We're going to use this unique opportunity to clear out once and for all the underground homeless from these areas. Now you have your assignments, and you have team leaders who've been chosen for their experience. There is no reason why these assignments cannot be completed with an hour or two to spare. We've made arrangements to provide these people with food and shelter for the night. Explain this to them as necessary. From the exit points marked on your maps, buses will take them to shelters in Manhattan and the other boroughs. We don't expect resistance, but if there is resistance, you have your orders."
He looked around at the assembled group for a moment, then raised the bullhorn again.
"Your fellow officers in the northern sections have been fully briefed and will begin their operations simultaneously with your own. I want everyone moving together. Remember, once underground, your radios will be of limited use. You may be able to communicate with each other and nearby team leaders, but above-ground communication will be intermittent at best. So keep to the plan, keep to the schedule, and do your part."
He stepped forward.
"And now, men, let's do some good."
The ranks of uniformed officers straightened up as Horlocker walked through them, clapping some on the back, dispensing encouraging words. As he was passing Hayward, he stopped, frowning. "You're Hayward, right? The Ghosta's girl?"
DeGosta's girl my ass.
I work with DeGosta, sir, she said out loud. Horlocker nodded.
Well, get to it, then.
Hey, sir, I think you'd better... Hayward began, but an aide had run up to Horlocker's side, babbling something about a rally in Central Park growing much